13-22-208-CV, Brian Michael Parks and ADS Air Conditioning, Inc. versus Nancy Meagle.
Yes, may it please the court. My name is Ross Pringle, and I represent Parks and ADS. They were defendants in the trial court below. Judges, there are three major issues in this appeal. There's the venue issue. There's the future medical issue, whether the plaintiffs, the appellees, I'm going to refer to them by their trial court nomenclature. It's just easier for me to put them in context in that regard. Whether That's the fine. Plaintiffs' physical inability to perform routine tasks such as household services, cooking, cleaning, laundry, driving, etc., are medical expenses or physical impairment. And then the third major issue is whether the trial court's submission of gross negligence claims against ADS, the employer defendant, was supported by the pleadings. Now, with 20 minutes, I'm going to prioritize my argument. And with the court's permission, I plan to focus primarily on issues 2 and 3, primarily because the trial court already granted a new trial on issues 2 and 3 down below, and then ultimately reversed herself in January of 2022. That's well reflected in the record.
But can I ask one quick question then on issue 1, just because
yes.
On the venue?
Yes, certainly.
Before you start on your argument then. So in your brief, yes, you stated that Parks had provided to his employer his home address, listed it on his W-4, and then there was an I-9 employment eligibility verification and a beneficiary designation. My question is, those documents that you described, were those in the record? Are they in the record? Or is the
only thing that we have is
the unsworn declaration?
I assume that I cited to the record in my brief in that regard. They may have been in the trial record, and they may just be in his declaration.
As we said today,
I'm not sure, Judge.
I tend to put these things in my notes, and then I didn't put the record cite. Okay, I'll check on that.
For what it's worth, I don't think either one of those statements were refuted or contradicted by any other venue evidence. And I'm sure I'm going to speak to venue because I do have that 5 minutes in rebuttal, and I suspect my opponent will speak to the venue issue, and so then I'll try to clean up as best I can in my 5 minutes.
Sounds good. Go ahead.
Back to the trial court's initial order on the motion for a new trial, the court reversed herself, and I submit and I believe, although, you know, in all candor, it's not reflected in the record, but I suspect that what happened was, given the brouhaha that arose out of that motion for a new trial entry of the order, the court determined that this thing was going up, and it was better to go up on a jury verdict and the sufficiency of the evidence to support a jury verdict rather than on a mandamus on a new trial order, which frankly is kind of ill-defined still, even since that Columbia case was decided about 10 years ago. I know there's a lot of appeals on that right now, and unfortunately that's kind of multiplied the numbers of appeals, mandamus and then a direct appeal. So I think that's the story behind that. Obviously, as I go along, any questions are welcome. Anything that I don't address, I do believe the venue issue has been briefed. I think it's well established. I think we've joined issue on all those major points. I think there are two main issues on that venue point that I just want to hit real quickly. There's two issues there. One is, does the plaintiff's prima facie proof go to residents at the time of the incident when the cause of action accrued, or does that evidence go to his residence 2 years before when his driver's license was issued? You can guess my position on that. Certainly the evidence goes to an irrelevant time, and I've made that point in my brief.
Counsel, the plaintiffs argue that we should apply the any probative evidence standard.
I'm sorry, Judge?
The plaintiffs argue that we should apply the any probative evidence standard instead of the prima facie proof of standard.
I agree with
that.
And what my evidence does, what our responsive evidence does, is it doesn't attack their evidence. It just goes to the inadequacy of the evidence that it's at the wrong time, not at the time the cause of action accrues. So we don't contest that he lived there 2 years before when his driver's license was issued. Our point is it just misses the mark in a temporal sense. The second issue on venue is it proper for this court to conclude or assume that the venue issue was waived when the motion was not heard during the many months of the COVID-19 pandemic? This case was filed in late 2019. We all remember what happened in March of 2020 and the 30 or 40 COVID orders that followed that regarding court procedures and things of that nature. So again, with the court's permission, that's really all I'm going to say about venue right now. And I'm going to stand on my briefing until, at least until I have to rebut. I'm going to start on the third issue, which is the punitive damage issue. Your Honors, in this case, the pleadings were that ADS, the corporate defendant, the employer, committed acts of gross negligence. Gross negligent entrustment, gross negligent hiring, retention, training, things of that nature. And they asked the jury in their pleadings to award damages against ADS, punitive damages, for its acts of gross negligence. Now, the plaintiffs in their reply brief say that the appellants focus exclusively on the allegations that ADS was grossly negligent in employing Parks. They say that in the reply brief at page 15. And that's true. That is exactly what trial counsel focused on, because that is what was alleged in the petition. However, at the close of evidence, the position changed. And now they changed the course of their theory, and now they did not submit a question asking if ADS was grossly negligent. And this was the question that was pleaded, alleged, they put on proof, it was defended apparently successfully because they did not submit an issue on it. And now at the charge conference, they asked the court to impute Adams, the employee's, gross negligence to his employer. And the defendants at trial objected at the charge conference. There are no pleadings to support that allegation of imputation of the individual defendant's gross negligence to the employer. Now, again, the trial court in the hearing on the motion for new trial stated on the record that the defendants were correct on this issue, and I've quoted that language from the hearing in our brief at page 36. So the trial court was convinced that we were correct, that they had not pleaded the theory that they went to the jury on.
And the theory would necessarily have to state what you've said, that the negligence of the employee should be imputed to the employer. That's
right.
What would have to be pled specifically.
Essentially what they did, Judge, was they pled that ADS was grossly negligent. They did not prove that ADS was grossly negligent. They just got punitive damages because of Parks' gross negligence that they then imputed up to ADS.
But this instruction that was included in the charge, I have my notes here, that says you can only find ADS grossly negligent if ADS was reckless in employing Parks. I mean, they have evidence to support that, and if so, then why isn't that enough to get over the...
Because that's not what they pled. They pled that ADS was negligent in the theories that they alleged, negligent hiring, negligent retention, et cetera. Not that Parks was unfit and that we were reckless in employing him. Now, the plaintiffs at trial, at the post-trial motions, and on appeal, make three arguments on this gross negligence issue. Number one, they say, well, we should have specially accepted. Defendants should have specially accepted. There's no need to specially accept to these pleadings because they were clear. The clear impetus of the pleadings was ADS committed gross negligence in the retention of Parks. Their theory of recovery was pleaded, it was clear, and there's no need to specially accept to that. I've cited the court to a case called Boss. It's a Supreme Court case at footnote 148 of our brief. And there's no need to specially accept to pleading which pleads a specific theory without a defect. Special exceptions are to correct defects or vagueness of pleadings. These pleadings were very clear and specific.
But why doesn't paragraph 21A cover the I guess, instruction that they submitted, where it says defendant failed to use reasonable care that a company would use in hiring, retaining, and then that Parks was unqualified and or incompetent. They didn't use the word unfit, but unqualified or incompetent. And
are we looking at their pleadings, Judge?
Yes, sir.
I think their pleadings are.
Why does that not cover it?
Pasted on page.
This is on page 88 of
right.
Their brief. Or maybe it's the
because, number one, they pleaded that not in their gross negligence claim, but in their negligence claim.
Well, right, but then in under gross negligence, they do say pleading for the conduct of defendants as described above rise to the level of gross negligence.
Well, they never gave us notice of the notion that they were trying to impute the gross negligence of an employee to the company. That's the point.
Okay.
And again, when they, we alleged, our proof at trial fended off all those allegations, and that's when they changed right before the charge conference, and we objected to it. I don't think that there's any requirement that we need to specially accept to the plaintiff's pleadings to suggest that they plead other theories unpleaded, or to inquire whether their pleadings encompassed other unpleaded theories. The second thing that the plaintiffs say is that the pleadings were clear, and they knew, and that we knew, that they were asking for gross or for punitive damages as a result of our conduct. But that's like saying, Judge, you know, we're seeking punitive damages against this defendant because of gross negligence, and then getting to the charge stage and saying, well, we didn't prove gross negligence, but we did prove an intentional act. You knew we were getting, we were asking for punitive damages, so now we want to submit an intentional act, which entitles us to gross negligence. You knew all along we were asking for gross negligence, no harm, no foul. The pleadings must conform to the theories submitted by the court.
Okay, you should probably move to medical issue because you're running.
Yes, I should. I should. Let me get to that. This was also cited by the court as justifying a new trial. So on the future medical finding, judges, the jury found future medical in the amount of $701,774. And credit to the plaintiffs, they caught several typos in my brief where I said it's $744. It is $774, and I thank them for that. That's important because that is the amount to the penny testified to by two witnesses. And that's Ms. Lampton, the RN, life care planner, and the economist. So what Ms. Lampton did was she projected what medical care the plaintiff would need, and she projected that, and she also projected what future household services she would need, that the plaintiff would need. Cooking, cleaning, laundry, driving, shopping, errands, anything like that. And she testified these were things that the husband and the daughter were doing. So then Keith Fairchild, the economist, came along and he ran those numbers out to a present value, and that was the $701,774. There's a good copy and paste of the trial exhibit number 142, which is in the appellee's brief at 68. And what you see there is of the $701,774, $73,443 is for medical costs, doctor visits, a cane, prescriptions, physical therapy, medical tests. And the rest are for these household services of cooking, cleaning, non-medical expenses.
Well, the plaintiffs have cited some case law where they say medically related personal care services can be recovered as future medical, and they make the distinction for physical impairment as being an award to compensate for the loss of enjoyment of life itself. Why do you disagree with that?
Judge, I've looked at those cases, and I don't read that loss of enjoyment of life, you get physical impairment for the things you enjoy doing that you're physically unable to do. And then medical expenses, you get separate compensation for your physical inability to do those things, which you need to do, the cooking, the cleaning.
So are you saying that the cost associated with the household services should not be recovered under either category?
No, it's clearly physical impairment, and I've cited
it. It should be included in physical impairment.
Correct.
Not future. Okay.
Correct.
So that's why you're saying it's a double dip here.
That's right, and we've cited the court to some cases there. They've cited some cases. I've read those cases very clearly. I think that the cases that we've cited certainly support our position that these are physical impairment damages and not medical expenses damage. Certainly, you know, the cost to heat up a can of soup is not a medical expense.
Okay, so your first 15 minutes are up.
Okay.
Hear from.
If I may, Judge, can I
go ahead.
Eat into my next five a little bit?
Sure, of course. That's your prerogative.
it's mine to lose, I guess. I have raised in my reply brief, and I know it's unorthodox. I have raised a fourth point that I did not raise in my original brief or in my I didn't raise it till the reply brief. And that is this Gregory versus Shohan issue.
Yes,
it kind of stands on its own. I realize it's unorthodox to bring it up late in the game, but it was just decided almost immediately before I had to file that reply brief.
Okay.
I offer it in there for the court's consideration as an additional alternative reason to reverse this case and remand it for a new trial.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Please, the court. Your Honor, let me address with the court's permission, the last point. Counsel fails to recognize that he raised that point in a reply brief. The Supreme Court says can't consider it. Let's add another component. Rule 324B4 specifically says any claim that there's incurable jury argument has to be presented in a motion for new trial. It's waived. That's easy. The others are equally easy. The court's already rightfully queried counsel about the broad nature of the plaintiff's complaint, petition in this case, state court, and the allegations that were made in it. We made very specific factual allegations in the original negligence claim and then incorporated those by reference in the punitive damages claim. And let's talk about what the defendant's own lawyer said. He asked questions about whether Mr. Parks was unfit to the owner of the company. He knew the words incompetent are defined as unqualified and unfit under the Webster's rule. And quite honestly, I don't know how we could have pled it any broader.
Except that you didn't have a question directly saying, was ADS grossly negligent? That's the distinction, is you asked the jury to impute the negligence
The answer is yes and no. Gross negligence is defined in part as recklessness. Our component of gross was included in the definition that they were reckless in employing him. So let me say that again. Gross negligence is included in the definition of gross negligence in employing him. We always asserted he was incompetent. We always asserted that they failed negligently entrusted, that they retained and acquired him knowing and recklessly. I mean, let's be clear. The defendants don't challenge the evidence that they're grossly negligent. They don't challenge that it was legally and factually sufficient. This driver was as bad as you could possibly have. He had 18,000 violations under the app that they had. On the very day of the incident, he violated the law 110 times. He ran a stop sign within 30 seconds prior to the collision based on the investigation of the case. He was traveling two times the legal speed limit at the time of the incident, was smoking, playing with the radio, and texting the president of the corporation a racist meme that they were exchanging communication at the very time the crash occurred. The employer testified he was an accident waiting to happen. He acted with willful blindness and indifference to safety. This is not a case where there's a question about the factual or legal sufficiency to support the evidence against the company or the driver. They don't challenge the pleadings against the driver either. They don't challenge the legal sufficiency against the driver. This case is a case of undisputed evidence at this level that both the driver and the company were grossly negligent. They say, King's X, we didn't have fair notice. They didn't accept, and the pleadings were broad enough. And I'll end with that. I candidly That issue is what evidence would they have offered differently at the trial? Nothing. It's the same issues that were raised. So again, I think plaintiff gave fair notice. The statute, the pattern jury charge does not say we have to plead the pattern jury charge. We pled they were reckless. We pled they were incompetent. We pled they were grossly negligent in hiring him and entrusting the vehicle. And I believe that's adequate. Let me go to the next, which is the home assistance, right? Counsel wrongfully contends the only evidence of future medical care or medical expenses. And let's make this clear. Medical expenses and activity that affects the life and involve the activities of daily living of a party. One, you're paying a third party, and one, you're having the consequences of it. Loss of the enjoyment of life includes things like I can't garden anymore. I don't go out dancing with my husband. That my activities that are involved in my life, it takes me four times as long as it did before. They had the benefit of something that you don't. Nancy Meagle, age 73, 10 days after this accident, she celebrated her birthday, spending 60 days in a hospital and a nursing home facility while her husband spent 60 days in another facility. She celebrated her birthday 3 days ago, age 77, still waiting for the results and fair compensation that the Cameron County jury provided her. We hired a board-certified life care planner who is an RN who has a specialty in elderly care. We cited to the court cases that specifically find that home assistance is a proper element of damages because there are expenses paid to a third party. There's a distinction between what you're paying a third party that
your
never goes...
Your proper element of damage, you say, of future medical care damages?
Medical care expenses. And I cited to the court, if you look at the definition, because think of it in this context. Would there be any dispute if Ms. Meagle was in a nursing home facility or assisted home facility that those expenses would be recoverable? Of course they would be.
Because your argument there is that the costs of the nursing home include all these types of services.
Absolutely. The difference is the right thing is those expenses would have been $2 million if it had been a third party. The right choice is a young lady, and I say that in a loving way, 67 going on two, all right, 77, all right, she was going to stay at her home, and she's entitled to be fairly compensated for those losses that would be incurred by her at 78, 79, 80, 81, 85 that she's likely to live for. And we had a board-certified life care planner with a specialty involving this area and elderly care, and the Texas Department of Human Services specifically says those non-technical expenses for activities of daily living are home expenses. They're compensated by Medicare and Medicaid as medical expenses. That's an easy decision too by the court. I think the failure of the defendants, because let's talk about what evidence they offered to contradict that. Well, there is none. The only evidence is, and let's add some other things. Nancy Meagle testified in a deposition. Her deposition was played to the jury. The deposition talked about what recommendations were being made for her future medical needs. She then testified at trial. She hobbled up on a cane, needed to be helped to the witness stand. The jury watched her as she physically hobbled back from the stand and testified since she'd been interviewed by life care planner specialist Lampton. She had two additional steroid injections. The doctor was recommending a third and was recommending future surgery to her arm. Yeah. That evidence alone is sufficient to support the future medical care expenses.
Sure, sure. I don't think they're disputing that. The question is whether the costs for those household services should have actually been factored in as impairment, as opposed to, or the jury did factor them in impairment.
And I think the answer is, the difference is, and it's a mindset that sometimes is missed. One, you're paying someone for the cost. She's never gonna get that as compensation. She's getting it to pay a third party. loss of the enjoyment of life is compensating her not for the expenses, but for the joy that she receives in gardening, dancing, etc. And the case law is that we cited is very clear. They're apples and oranges, and the jury, in its discretion, had a right to choose to award it or not award it. They had the testimony of her. They had her testimony at her observations at trial. They had the life care planner. They had the Dr. Fairchild's opinions. And by the way, the statement was a little misstated. Ms. Lambton testified to an amount. Dr. Fairchild reduced or increased it to present value. Medical expenses are greater than inflation, so the number's different. Their original challenge was all of it's not valid. All of it isn't. That they've confirmed today that more than 70,000 of it, well, they go, we agree that's medical expenses, but the balance of it is included within impairment other than the ability to earn money. They disregard something else. The jury was instructed, do not consider in one element of damages what you award in the other element of damages. Again, what evidence do they have? The jury disregarded it. Again, none. Speculation on their part, and the jury did exactly what they were told to do, is compare them equally but separately and consider the element for expenses on one side and the loss and the emotional torment and the issues associated with that on the other. Again, there's no challenge to that element of damages. They're not claiming there's lack of legal or factual sufficiency under impairment, under mental anguish, under past medical expenses. The only challenge is, well, it's already included, and their evidence to support that is pure speculation. The cases say that it's relevant. The cases say that it is a separate element of damages, and again, their response to that reference to the human services requirement is they don't respond at all to it, because it is recognized both federally and state as an expense. Expenses for living and care at your residence are just as much medical expenses as if you went to a nursing home. And that's what the life care plan specialist referenced, and there was no testimony to the contrary. Let's go to the venue issue, because this case and the comment made by Justice Silva was right on the point. The standard of review in a 15002 case is different than the standard of review in a 15003 case. To remind the court, 15003 is when someone files a claim, there's a venue hearing, and then you join new parties. It's kind of a do-over in the second one. In the first one, it is not a de novo review by you. You can't do it. It's not a factual sufficiency review by you. You're prohibited from doing it. You're not allowed to say, well, I think the evidence preponderates more towards the defendant than the plaintiff. You're not allowed to do it. The only issue is there any probative evidence to support the judge's finding, and the court needs to do something else. They say the lens is look for a way to reverse the trial judge's decision. The lens is the polar opposite. Your instruction and your duty under the standard review is to put blinders on and look for the evidence that supports the judge's decision. Big difference. They want you to say, well, we think it preponderates more of one than the other. If there is a factual dispute, the standard you're bound by says that's a fact issue. It doesn't destroy the evidence that the plaintiffs have offered, and the court must affirm the judge's decision. So let me say that
you cite the case law that says precisely what you just said, that if there you have evidence that destroys the plaintiff's evidence, and other than, I realize you're critical of the fact that they have an unsworn declaration that they have provided, but there was also, I think, deposition testimony where Mr. Parks mentioned, used the word home, that he would drive home and leave the van at home or the vehicle at home every day. So why does that, if that evidence shows that he was living in, is it Goliad County?
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the incident, why does that not destroy the plaintiff's evidence?
Great question. We cited in the brief. First of all, you can have two residences. I call Wisconsin home. I call where I go home when I visit my mother home. I've lived in Texas longer than I've lived in the state of Wisconsin. My nephew is a Marine. He was at the wall in Afghanistan. He called home the base he was located at, but his residence was there. It was really this simple. And I want to talk about the procedural failure that occurred involving that unsworn declaration that's really technical. I've got about 5 minutes, but I want the court to understand it. The unsworn declaration never says the following: the statement in my driver's license involving my residence is not accurate. It does not say the police report's finding. Remember, an investigating officer is charged by statute and under the Texas Transportation Code to determine the driver's residence on the date of the wreck. Let me say that again. They're required to determine the residence on the date of the wreck. They ask the drivers, is this your current residence, 100% of the time? And the evidence in the case is the same here. So that evidence alone is enough. But let's add to that. He was issued a citation. The citation on the top of it says residence, and he signed off on the document on the bottom. That evidence is not subject to rebuttal. It's not subject to cross-examination. It's not subject to contrary evidence at the venue stage. Because look, when I first started, and my hair was a different color and I had much more of it, there's another gentleman here that's probably a little longer in the tooth, Mr. Schwartz behind me, but the plea of privilege was 90%, 80% of the appellate record. Everyone appealed a plea of privilege. So the legislature, in its wisdom, finally said, enough. You guys are busy enough working on other things. Let's create a standard that changes the burden on how to establish it, and is now prima facie evidence. And prima facie evidence is there any rational inference from the evidence to support it? Think of this. At the time that he's issued a citation, if he really was living somewhere else and then he showed up at the municipal court and didn't appear, where would they send the officers to go arrest him? At his residence that he reflected on the citation and on the police report. And is there any probative evidence? The police report, the abstract, the driver's license, the citation. You asked the question, where's in the evidence the record involving the I-9, et cetera? It's in the employment file. It's in the employment file. And it was at the trial. Okay.
But in the record before us, the citation in the brief is to the unsworn declaration.
I say it again.
In the brief, in the record before us, the citation to that argument that they've made is to the unsworn declaration.
That's correct. And let me add that, because that's one thing that's hard to understand. There was a 21-month delay between the time this case originally was, the motion was filed and the actual hearing. The argument that COVID did it, if I haven't heard that once, I've heard it a million times in case. Judge Rancone basically decided there was no COVID, and I say that she was the most busy judge in the world. They had no problem setting for hearing a motion.
I don't think we can take judicial notice of that.
I got you.
There was a lot of delay everywhere.
But I will say this. Judge Rancone's, they got an order from her saying that they could take the deposition of 24 depositions on written questions for healthcare providers. Didn't have any problem getting an order in that regard. The unsworn declaration was filed less than 45 days prior to the motion to transfer venue hearing. It was only filed, this is very important procedurally, it was only filed to support the motion to transfer venue of Parks. Let me say it again. It was only filed to support the motion to transfer venue filed by Parks. We've cited to it in the record. The lawyer said, Your Honor, I'm adding an unsworn declaration to support the declaration of Parks. No one provided the declaration to support the motion to transfer venue of ADS. Problem, okay? Add to that. The judge said, you know, counsel for Ms. Meagle, Mr. Webb, Mr. Ciano, Mr. Schwartz, have raised the issue. You just file that. I can't hear that. You've got to give them 45 days notice. Do you want to go forward on your original motion, which didn't include the unsworn declaration? He said yes. We went forward, and then when we had that hearing, the court said, well, I looked at everything, but legally she was required to do this because of what happened. One step further, and this is the coup d'etat of the destruction of the unsworn declaration for your ability to review it. The defendant, in their decision, 4 days before trial, filed a second amended motion to transfer venue. They filed a second amended. The unsworn declaration wasn't attached to it. The unsworn declaration wasn't even referred to it. And when a party files an amended pleading, it supersedes and replaces the prior motion. Their live pleading for the motion to transfer venue sitting before you is not supported by an unsworn declaration, not as to Mr. Parks, never as to ADS. If there was ever a case, justices, where the decision involving venue is easy, it's this one. If there was ever a case that it was easy involving the pleadings given the broad allegations, Justice, Chief Justice, that you referenced, it's easy. And the case law abundantly supports the ability to use future medical care expenses related to this treatment at a residence. Unless the court has any additional questions, I'm out of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Yes.
Judges.
You will have your five that you reserved.
Go okay. ahead. Five minus a little, looks like.
No, that's okay.
So, judges, there is absolutely zero connection of this accident to Cameron County. It happened hundreds of miles away. Ms. Meagle lived hundreds of miles away. My client lived hundreds of miles away. And ADS was headquartered hundreds of miles away. The only sliver of any venue fact is my client's driver's license 2 years before showing a Cameron County address.
But it does beg the question why he wouldn't have corrected the officer who issued the citation, and I mean, he was asked this information.
I am not aware of any evidence that the officer asked him anything, and he said, oh, yes, I live in Cameron County. I think it's just as likely that he writes down whatever's on his address. Everything, every bit of evidence here that they point to comes from that license. The driver's excerpts, the driving record, the citation. If they had asked the police officer anywhere in a deposition or in any format, did you ask him what his residence was, and he said Cameron County, that would be different. There is zero evidence of that in this record. The distinction between ADS's motion and Parks's motion is they were joint defendants. They filed a single motion. It was joined together, and they both alleged the same basis for transfer of venue. And the basis for transfer of venue was to Victoria County, where ADS had its principal place of business. The simple fact of the matter is that that the plaintiff's evidence just went to the wrong period of time. And the court asked about the I-9, and I'm glad Mr. Ciano corrected me on this because I was not the trial counsel at this case, and I didn't even attend trial. My law partner did. But the evidence of the I-9 and his employment file clearly showed trial evidence that he resided in Goliad County at the time of this accident, 2 years after his license was issued.
But is that employment file in the record before us?
Yes, it should be if it was admitted into evidence.
Okay.
Under that Ruiz versus, I believe it's Ruiz versus Conoco, the Supreme Court has instructed that on a venue review by the Court of Appeals, the court looks at the entire record. And so you're entitled to look at, and I've quoted in my brief.
Because your brief cites to the unsworn declaration only. It doesn't cite to anywhere else in the record. That's the only reason I asked. But we'll find it if it's there.
Well, that's probably my shortcoming, Judge. But one thing I have cited the court to is an extended exchange at trial between Mr. Parks and the plaintiff counsel about where he lived. And the court picked up on that just a minute ago. I took the van home every day. Where was home? In Goliad County. Now, to his credit, counsel was very careful not to ask him where he lived, But he danced around that to avoid that for fear of upsetting the venue issue, because the all the evidence was that my client did not live in Cameron County at the time of the accident. This issue of whether we invoked the court's jurisdiction, they cited the court to a couple of cases where people go to trial and get a judgment without asserting a motion to transfer venue or getting a ruling on it. That's not what happened here. We have cited the court in footnote 99 of our brief, the multiple efforts and the multiple attempts to get our motion to transfer venue heard over time, and that's unrefuted. But to say that by entering into agreements to conduct discovery or to obtain medical records by DWQs, depositions on written questions, waives the right to transfer venue, does violence to the rule which says discovery is not suspended by the pendency of a motion to transfer venue. In fact, we ought to be doing discovery during the pendency of a motion to transfer venue to avoid the issues that we've got in this case. So clearly, we didn't do anything to invoke the court's jurisdiction in accordance with the cases that they cite to waive the motion to transfer venue. The cases that they cite encompass much more intense activity by the defendants, evidencing an intent to waive. The other issue, Judge, is on this, well, I really don't have time. I'm going to rely on my briefing in terms of the household services aspect as being clearly physical impairment damages and not medical expenses.
Yes. The briefs are well done, and we appreciate that.
Thank you, Judge.
Yours was a little lengthy. The case will be under submission.
Thank you
very much. Good to see you all.